He's calling in now.
Good morning and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee. And we're a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonald, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director.
Good morning.
We're also joined on the telephone by somebody who's usually here in the studio with us, Ron Deutsch. Ron's in Baltimore. Ron has been for several years the executive director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness, but he's the new interim executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute.
This is Brian McDonald, and I'd also like to welcome our listeners this morning to The People's Business on WRPI Troy. Later in today's program, we'll be speaking with State Senator John Flanagan about the November 4th elections and the outlook for the 2015 legislative session, and with Susan McCormick about two interesting presentations on New York history that will be taking place later this week and which are free and open to the public. One is a lecture about Nelson Rockefeller, who was New York's governor for nearly 15 years from 1959 through 1973. The other is a presentation about the workers who built the Erie Canal. But before we hear from Susan and Senator Flanagan, we have a few minutes to catch up with our colleague Ron Deutsch, who had a big day yesterday. He was appointed to serve as the Fiscal Policy Institute's new interim executive director. Ron, thank you for taking the time to join us from Baltimore, Maryland.
My pleasure, gentlemen. How's everybody doing this morning?
Great, but cold. I bet it's warmer where you are right now.
Probably a little bit. I'm looking out my window at Baltimore's beautiful inner harbor, and there's no snow to be seen anywhere. Sorry to say.
So, Ron, what's new with you?
Oh, well, quite a bit, Brian, as you just pointed out, and as Frank just pointed out, I am very pleased to be appointed as the interim executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute. It's an organization that I've had great respect for over the years, certainly under Frank's leadership and then under Fred Sloss's leadership. And I'm looking forward to taking over and moving the organization forward. So it's very exciting, and actually I'm down here in Baltimore right now at the State Priorities Partnership Conference, which is kind of the national organization, a national group that the Fiscal Policy Institute belongs to and has been a part of for many, many years. And actually our own host here, Frank Morrow, was honored last night, or was mentioned last night as being honored because he was one of the pioneers of this movement. Actually, Fiscal Policy Institute was, I believe, one of the first 12, if not the first, organization that works on budget and revenue issues like this as part of this network.
Yeah, the Fiscal Policy Institute was one of the original 12 state groups, one each in each of 12 states. There's now groups, either fully certified and functioning fiscal analysis groups or groups at a planning stage in over 40 of the states.
Yeah, it's a great event. There's workshops every day. We had meetings with the directors yesterday, so I'm learning a lot and meeting with a lot of peers and colleagues, and it's been a great learning experience. I'm hoping to take a lot of this information back to Albany with me and put it to good use.
Well, congratulations to Frank for being honored, and congratulations to you, Ron, in your new position. I get the impression, Ron, that you're going to have to hit the ground running. I hear that FPI has some interesting events coming up just in December. Can you tell us a little bit about what's on the agenda?
Sure. Well, first we have an event on December 5th at the Friday Breakfast, where we'll be honoring Senator Liz Krueger. As you guys know, very few senators have done more to discuss income inequality, to promote fair taxation, and to help working families than Senator Krueger has. She's been a tireless advocate for working families and the poor in New York, and I think it's only appropriate that we honor her, since she's supported so much of the work of the Fiscal Policy Institute over the years through her own policy development and proposals. So that's one of the events we have coming up. And then there's another very interesting event that we have coming up on December 9th. We're actually partnering with Cornell University for the first time, which I think is very exciting as well. And we'll be looking at basically how austerity in New York, or limited state funding combined with the local property tax cap combined now with the property tax freeze. How is all that affecting our municipalities throughout the state? And is it causing fiscal stress? And we would suggest it most certainly is causing fiscal stress. So we're going to have a number of different speakers, a number of different breakout sessions on different topics, where we really look at the impact of the tax cap. We look at the impact of these austerity measures and begin to see how can we help our cities, towns, and villages across the state thrive. Because, as you well know, many of these cities, towns, and villages are having a very difficult time continuing to provide quality services and, you know, making sure that they don't raise their property taxes. So the governor has really made this, I believe, is going to be a centerpiece, is push towards consolidation. And that's something that we all need to address. And I think Dr. Mildred Warner at Cornell has already done some very interesting research on consolidation and shared services. And it pretty much clearly shows that the savings that the governor hopes to achieve are greatly overblown from this type of consolidation and or shared service. So I think it's important that the public begin to understand that. And we've certainly seen time and time again when there are votes for consolidation or merging towns and villages that voters reject that because by local government.
If you're interested in learning more about the conference that Ron is speaking about, it's entitled Local Fiscal Stress, State Austerity Policy, and Creative Local Response. It's in Saratoga Springs on December 9th, being co-hosted by the Fiscal Policy Institute and Cornell University's Rural Research Institute called CARDI. And you can get more information about the conference at CARDI, CARDI.cornell.edu. Ron, thanks for the updates about FPI and its work. We know you're on a tight schedule, but I'd like to take some time on a substantive issue. Give us a quick update of New York's fiscal situation and how the policy debate about the state's surplus or windfall is shaping up.
So right now, New York, according to the governor, is in a good fiscal situation where we have surplus dollars. We also have these settlement monies that were garnered through legal settlements with a variety of different banks for their bad business practices. We're moving forward, obviously, trying to figure out, as many other groups are right now, on how to spend that money wisely. So at the Fiscal Policy Institute, we'll be building coalitions and looking at a variety of different ways on how to best spend this money. But I think a lot of groups have been pushing for infrastructure investments, which is something we certainly support and think is wise. But I think we also need to be looking at, you know, how do we help our struggling cities, towns, villages, counties continue to deliver quality services? They've been asked to do more with less over the last few years. And I think we're going to need to reinvest in our cities, towns, and villages in order to help them thrive and have you know, livable communities throughout New York. I think we're also going to be looking at the fact that we want to push for the end of this austerity budgeting that the governor has been employing here, and in particular his self-imposed 2% state spending cap. So I think we're going to have to be looking at that. And one of the things the governor will be talking about this year as well is reducing property taxes. So we're going to look at, you know, promoting a progressive state and local tax structure that works for everybody, not just the favored wealthy few in New York State.
So we're talking about the surplus in New York State that we expect to have in 2015. And Ron was also mentioning the conference that that FPI is going to be participating in. Ron, I think it's a very timely issue. I think 2015 could be the year of local government. You know, a lot of people in local government feel like they've been facing the perfect storm. And that was the property tax cap that prevented them from raising revenue. the drastic cuts in local aid that Governor Cuomo has implemented under his administration, and the rising pension costs that were caused by the shenanigans on Wall Street. So it's been a very difficult time for local government. So I think that sounds like a fascinating conference.
Yeah, the governor tends to, it sounds almost as if he's blaming local government. Mm-hmm.
He
seems to say that we wouldn't have high property taxes if it wasn't for our local government structure. But the local government structure hasn't changed for decades, mm-hmm. and property taxes go up. The other thing that's changed is state aid has gone down. So the governor deserves a lot of credit for his turning the tables on reality, but his cutting
a bit disingenuous, you would suggest, huh, Frank?
Well, his cutting of state aid probably has more to do with the increased pressure on the property tax than anything else. But he's repeated so many times that the reason we have high property taxes is because of the duplication and fragmentation of local government, but that hasn't changed.
No, it hasn't changed. And, you know, I mean, he also asserts that there are over 10,000 local governments in New York State, which we know is not true. There's about a third of that, if even that many. So, you know, the reality is the governor is what I would suggest is victim blaming here. And you can look at that with schools, and you can look at that with cities, towns, and villages across the state. He's basically saying, hey, it's your fault. I tightened my belt, now you need to tighten your belt. But the reality is the way he tightened his belt was, you know, by putting his belt around their neck. So he's been cutting funding for them and asking them to do more with less, and it's disingenuous at best and bad public policy, to say the least.
We should explain how it can be that the governor says there are 10,000 local governments and the U.S. Census Bureau says there are 3,000 and the controller says there's 3,000. The difference is the governor is counting as governments taxing districts. So within
right.
counties and towns, a town, for example, can provide services to one part of a town and not to another part, whether it's water or sewer or lighting. And to make sure that only the properties that benefit from that service pay for it, various taxing districts are created, and the levy to go to pay for the sewer or water or lighting is apportioned only to the properties that benefit from it. And so you only get from 3,000 to 10,000 by counting taxing districts, and taxing districts aren't governments. They're accounting vehicles for towns and counties to fairly apportion the cost of extra services.
Well, that's exactly right. So the town that I live in has several light districts and water and sewer districts, and there are no employees. There are really no taxes involved there. They're just paper districts. It's a way of organizing the way that the town is structured. But the governor has taken this number and run with it and really sort of told a story that's not entirely accurate about the size of local government.
Well, he's quite adept at telling inaccurate stories, I would suggest.
Well, this is The People's Business on WRPI Troy. We've been speaking with our colleague Ron Deutsch, who is the executive director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness and is the newly named interim executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute. Ron, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us, and enjoy your conference.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Take care.
If you're interested in learning more about the conference on local fiscal stress, state austerity policy, and creative local response, and perhaps attending that conference, which is being co-hosted by the Fiscal Policy Institute and Cornell University, is on December 9th in Saratoga Springs, and information is available on the Cornell Rural Research Institute website, which is CARDI, CARDI.cornell.edu. Later in today's program, we're going to be speaking with State Senator John Flanagan about the results of the recent elections in New York State and the outlook for 2015. Before we do that, to get a little preview, Brian, what are your thoughts on what we should be keeping an eye on in the next few months as far as the outlook for 2015 stands?
Well, so, I mean, I think there's a lot to talk about. Since the last time we met on this show, there were state elections and some fascinating things happened. We're going to be talking later on with Senator Flanagan, who is going to be a member of the Republican majority in the state Senate in 2015. So we can talk about the politics of that. And also, I think the topic of local government is going to be a recurring theme in 2015. We've got a governor who, when he came in, recognized a problem that in New York State, we have high property taxes. The problem is that every year he points to a solution, tries to fix it, but that's not, in fact, the solution to the problem. So the first year he came in, he said property taxes are too high. We need a tax cap. property taxes didn't go down. The next year, he said, well, pensions are too lucrative for government employees. So he made a move to reduce pensions. Property taxes didn't go down. The next year, he said that binding arbitration for law enforcement is the problem. He made some changes to that, and property taxes didn't go down. So last year, he said, we have to freeze the local government. We have to force consolidation. Legislators, many of whom come out of local government and are responsive to their constituents who don't want to see their local governments go away, pushed back a little bit. But he did try to force some consolidation of local government. So this is a guy who every year has the same problem, and every year he says there's a new solution, which of course is not the solution. But I think we're going to be hearing a lot about local government.
And we're going to be talking more about this at 8:35 with a state senator who holds two positions which make him very relevant to the concerns that Brian McDonald just raised. We're going to be speaking with State Senator John Flanagan, who's chairman of the Senate Education Committee, so he has a lot to do with school aid and the finances of school districts, and he's also the deputy Republican conference leader for intergovernmental affairs. At 8:15, we're going to be speaking with Susan McCormick, who's the coordinator of Researching New York, a conference on New York history that University at Albany hosts each fall. It's this coming week. But this year, and I think this is also true last year, as part of the Researching New York Conference, there's going to be two events that are free and open to the public, and they're on interesting topics that relate to government historically in New York State. So we're now pleased to be joined by Susan McCormick, the coordinator of the Researching New York Conference, a New York History Conference that's being held at the University at Albany later this week. Susan, thank you for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Good morning. It's fun to be here on the other side of the microphone with you guys.
We're happy to have you. This is Brian McDonald, and I'd also like to welcome our guest, Susan McCormick, for the show this morning. Susan, on Thursday evening at 7:30, the author of a new biography on Nelson Rockefeller that's been getting quite a lot of attention will be speaking at the Page Hall Auditorium at the University of Albany's downtown campus. Can you tell us a little bit about Richard Norton Smith and his book, Thursday night?
Well, let me just begin by expanding a little bit on what Frank said. Researching New York is an annual conference on New York State history sponsored by the Department of History at the University and by the Archives Partnership Trust. There's more than 20 events in addition to the two free public events that we always do. And for people who want more information on the entire conference, they can check that out at www.nystatehistory.org, where they'll also find information on the two public events we're going to talk about. And indeed, especially for folks in this area, the Richard Norton Smith event, a discussion of his new biography on his own terms, The Life of Nelson Rockefeller, I think is of particular interest to folks in this region. Richard Norton Smith is a librarian, an archivist, a historian. Many people will know him from his appearances on C-SPAN, where he's often described as C-SPAN's in-house historian. He's directed several presidential libraries and also is close ties to New York State history. His earlier work on Thomas Dewey was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize previously. But this book he's been working on for about 14 years, has access to a lot of interviews previously unavailable. At one point, Nelson Rockefeller was considering writing his own memoir, and there have been interviews with a number of, as you might imagine, prominent people, and those interviews were sealed. But over the course of the 14 years that Smith was working on the biography, these folks passed away, and their interviews were unsealed, so he has access to lots of material that has been previously unavailable.
Nelson Rockefeller was an activist governor, if anything, responsible for the expansion of the State University of New York, the current 64 campus, the largest university system in the country, responsible for the Empire State Plaza, which in effect remade the face of Albany, and it's relatively recent history. Besides the Thursday evening lecture by Richard Norton Smith on Nelson Rockefeller, and before we move to the next event, we should
remind people that this is at 7:30 on Thursday evening at Page Hall Auditorium. It's on the downtown campus. It's near the intersection of Robin with both Washington and Western Avenue. I think that's correct.
The official address is 135 Western Avenue. Page Hall is best approached from the Western Avenue entrance closest to Lake Avenue, but it is between Robin and Lake, just as you approach the park on the downtown University campus. Again, 7:30 Page Hall, and of course, free to the public, and we're happy to have anyone who's at all interested.
Besides the Thursday evening lecture by Richard Norton Smith, there's also another event that's open to the public. This one is on Friday afternoon, and it brings history and the creative arts together. Tell us about this event.
It does. We're really fortunate. Maggie Mastelli Cahill, who many will know is the artistic producing director of our local Capitol Repertory Theater, has written a play called They Built America, The Workers of the Erie Canal, based solely on historical records and historical documents to bring to life some of the people who were so involved in the building of the Erie Canal. It's a live performance with some of the rep actors, along with the discussion of the creation of this and why programs like this are important as public history. And ultimately, this will be touring in schools in the spring. And Rena Kosersky, a music historian and musicologist, will also be there to talk about how the music that accompanies this program was created and researched from historical documents. And so again, that's at the Uptown campus at the University of Albany, on the Recital Hall and the Performing Arts Center at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon. And again, that's free and open to the public, and we invite everyone to come and join us.
Is the music folk music or some other kind of music?
That's a good question. I think I have not heard it, but based on what I understand of Rena's work and George Ward, who also is a performer of historical music, I think it could be considered folk music in the sense that it's music of the time drawn from the historical records, sheet music, and so on. I'm sure some of the songs will be familiar to people, but they're played and presented based on what people were singing and talking about at the time.
Will George Ford be part of the event on Friday?
I believe that's kind of up in the air. We're hoping he will be. Certainly his contribution to the music research for this will be very apparent, and we're hoping that he'll also be taking part.
The Erie Canal was built and rebuilt several times. Why is it such an important part of New York?
Well, as the discussion and the setup for the play suggest, that it really opened up the West. It was the first major opening of the West, which allowed for expansion into the frontier and in trade as well as settlement.
In terms of the time when this occurred, as I understand it, the first building of the Erie Canal, which was called Clinton's Ditch, started around 1817, and it was built gradually. It opened with a very short span between Utica and Rome. It was basically then extended to Syracuse, then was extended both going east and west, and they had a big celebration in 1825 when they completed it from, from Albany to Lockport. Was that the distance?
I believe so. I'm a little hazy on the end point at that particular date, but basically Western New York. And yes, 1825 was the celebration. 1925 was the centennial. And we're coming up, and one of the reasons why it's getting so much attention again is we're coming up in 2025 to the bicentennial.
Well, and it really made New York a commercial powerhouse, right? At the time
Absolutely.
That it was being built, I think Philadelphia had a larger harbor and was bringing more revenue in. But then when the Erie Canal was built, there was a population boom. There was massive revenue coming into New York State. It really transformed our state and our country.
It did. It was part of the westward expansion. But also something that perhaps folks less
focus on a little bit less is all along this east-west route, there were settlements that grew north of it and south of us and expanded the population of New York State significantly.
Fascinating story. And these workers just cut through whatever came in their way.
Absolutely. And again, I think Maggie's research and what she's put together is interesting, both because of the form, this documentary form of theater that they're choosing to present this in, but based on those historical records from, as she says, from George Washington to Irish orphan Molly to Dr. Finch, who was a physician, to Antonio, the Italian mason, and so on. So here we often have the political story, Clinton's ditch, all of that. But here we also have a human story based on individuals and their records and what they said and how they experienced this this development, this growth.
The people who are featured as having built America in this context are politicians, farmers, merchants, laborers, all the people who in one way or another worked on this. This live performance featuring professional actors from Capitol Repertory Theater is free and open to the public, and it's co-sponsored by the University at Albany Public History Program. And it's, as we said, free and open to the public on the Uptown campus in the Recital Hall in the Performing Arts Center.
Right.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy. We've been speaking with Susan McCormick, the coordinator of the Researching New York Conference, about two fascinating events that are coming up. And as Frank mentioned, they're free and open to the public. Susan, thanks for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
And I'm just going to get in one last
plug.
For any information on the conference itself, the entire conference, or these two public events, you can check out www.nystatehistory.org.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
nyhistory.org for information on the conference and the public events.
Let me just say it's NY State. Otherwise, you'll get you'll get the New York City Historical Association.
Okay.
So we want nystatehistory.org.
I apologize for
getting that wrong. No apologies necessary, just let it not confuse.
Thank you,
Seth.
That's right. That's great.
Right.
Well, thank you, Susan, for joining us. Frank, before we take a station break, what are your thoughts on some of the issues that have been that we discussed a few moments ago about using this surplus that that we've been talking about, the nearly $5.1 billion that New York State has, the windfall that New York State has received in legal settlements from some of the bad actors in the financial services community?
Well, one of the things I find ironic about the debate over the surplus is after an announcement earlier last week by the Education Conference Board making the case for using some of the resources for dealing with the gap elimination adjustment, which had been used to help balance the state budget by cutting school aid. The governor's communications director reiterated that they didn't want to use any of the money for operating expenses. And I think while there's some logic to that, and I'd like to expand upon what I see as the way to flesh that out. One of the problems, I think, is the governor has created some of the misunderstanding himself, because one of the things that he and his spokespeople have repeated is that he inherited a $10 billion deficit and transformed it into a $4 billion surplus. Now, I should explain a couple of things about both ends. By talking about it in that direction, it makes it sound like the numbers are equivalent. So it certainly makes it sound like it's a surplus. But the governor, at the same time, he's trying to take credit for transforming a $10 billion deficit into a $4 billion surplus. It's really $5 billion now. He is making them sound very similar. So let's deal with each side of that. The $10 billion deficit. The main reason we got rid of the main reason we were able to get rid of the $10 billion deficit was that the governor got the legislature to agree to tone down certain commitments. So we had a commitment to fully fund the settlement to the Campaign for Fiscal Equity lawsuit, and that was embodied in the financial plan. But the governor basically changed the promise. So I can't argue that it's not a important development for dealing with the budget in an accounting way that's understandable. But it isn't as if we did $10 billion of budget cuts. We basically reduced our commitment to education and did several billion dollars of real cuts, but also stretched out and reduced the ultimate commitment. The $4 billion surplus, yes, a lot of that is due to the one-time money, but part of it is also due to the fact that there's a below-the-line reduction in projected spending based on the 2% cap on state spending. So it's a very complicated situation, and we'll talk about it more over the coming months. But before we do that, we have a chance to talk about many more timely issues, including last week's, or I guess it's 2 weeks ago now, time flies, the election. But we're very pleased to be joined on the telephone now by Senator John Flanagan, who has two very relevant roles to the future of local government in New York State. He's chairman of the Senate Education Committee, and he's the deputy Republican conference leader for intergovernmental relations. So, Senator Flanagan, thank you very much for joining us.
Morning.
Senator Flanagan, this is Brian McDonald. Welcome to the show. We've been talking today a little bit about the election results 2 weeks ago, and congratulations to you and to your conference for grabbing a clear majority in the chamber that that you've been a member of since 2002. And also, we're talking about some of the legislative issues that that the both houses will be facing heading into 2015. So congratulations, and I think you're actually in Albany right now for an organizational meeting for the Republican conference, so we'd love to hear your thoughts.
Sure. We had a good day yesterday. We had a conference, and it's a very unique time, and it's a great feeling, frankly, to have seven new members that you can welcome in as part of your conference. And we had an opportunity to reelect Senator Skelos as the true and legitimate and clear majority leader. And, you know, it was really interesting and kind of heartwarming in some respects because of the diversity of the people that are now the newest members of our conference. A lot of them have unique type backgrounds, and some of them are involved in small business. A couple have served in our military back from recent deployments. So I'm very gratified by the time we had a chance to spend with them yesterday. And it's a good refresher for everybody. It kind of reinvigorates what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to do it and provide a good, healthy orientation for them. But Senator Skelos opened a dialogue on a lot of important issues that we're going to be talking about as we move into the new session. And I think that he made it clear, and we're seeking our support to continue to have good collegial relations with members not only in the Senate but in the Assembly and the Executive. And that resonates with the public, and I think that that was apparent in the electoral process. And we came out, fortunately, I think for a lot of reasons, on the very positive end of that ledger this time.
So I have to ask you, I looked at the results of these elections, and everybody was talking about how it was going to be a squeaker. When you look at the election results for many of your new colleagues, they weren't that close. So a lot of your colleagues who we thought were going to win by 1 or 2 points, many of them won by, you know, Jack Martins from the 7th Senatorial District won by 12. You know, George Amador from this region was elected. Everyone thought that was going to be very close. He won by 12. Rich Funke out in Monroe County defeated sitting Senator Ted O'Brien by 17 points. Did you think that the margin was going to be so large in some of these races?
No, you know what? I thought it was going to be good. And let's look at it this way. We have the luxury of having a conversation right now where we can speculate on things like that. But I will say this. I do believe very clearly that Kathy Young, who headed the campaign committee, working with many others, in particular Leader Skelos, he remained sort of maniacally focused on what were our basic goals. So I would say go back to taxes, job spending. You know, people say in real estate it's location, location, location. Here it's taxes, job spending, and that had been the mantra all along. I also must add, having watched closely and yet from a distance, I think the negative tone of some of these campaigns did have a reverberation, and I think the Democratic candidates paid a price for some of the antics during the campaign, and people saw through that. There was a tremendous amount of negativity. You mentioned George Amador. The amount of money that was spent there is almost legendary. I saw some of the things that happened on Long Island, but I believe that the people are willing to give us a chance, and the good news is that we have the corresponding obligation and responsibility that we welcome.
Well, I have to say, you know, we don't live in a presidential state that's considered a real battleground. So we're not normally in presidential years inundated by these ads that people, you know, say in Ohio or Pennsylvania are. But this year you couldn't turn the TV on without seeing a political ad. It was really something.
Yeah, and where just as a subsegment of that, where I live, you had a very contested congressional race mm-hmm. where I would say the expenditures from the committees, the candidates, and independent groups was well over $15 million, and maybe closer to $20 million, and that's just for a congressional race. Mm-hmm. So there was, let's put it this, there were a lot of consultants and a lot of TV stations, radio stations that had a very healthy dose of revenue come in over that's the last right. couple of months.
An interesting point that Senator Skelos made in the statement that he released yesterday was the following. I think this is very interesting. He said, of the 10 most Democratic states in the country and the 20 legislative chambers located within those states, the New York State Senate is the only one controlled by Republicans, end quote. What do you think explains that situation?
I would like to think that it goes back to very basic fundamentals and principles, including what are we doing about jobs? You know, I think, and I was contemplating coming on the show, what's important and what resonates with the taxpayers? First of all, people expect elections to be tough. They expect them to probably be longer than they wanted. But after that, very clearly, they want us to govern. They want to know what we're going to do to make their lives better, how we're going to do it, and frankly, how quickly are we going to do it, and who are we going to work with to get that done. So there's an expectation that we will lead, that we'll come up with policies that will promote things that are good for people. But I look at very basic things. What are we doing to create jobs in the state of New York? What kind of framework, what kind of structure, what kind of guidance are we going to have for people who are entrepreneurial? What are we doing for working men and women? What are we doing for people in the labor movement? And I think the Republican Party has shown that we have a deep and abiding interest in all facets of our economy and all sectors of our economy, both public and private. But I think we have been listening to the people and have stayed very focused on what are our core points, and I believe now with a clear majority that we will do two very basic things. We will continue to work with our colleagues in a collegial and bipartisan fashion, but we're also going to stake out positions that hopefully will resonate with the public.
So you mentioned a clear majority. I think for our listeners, we have to sort of explain what that means in the state Senate, why that's so important. So I have to explain to my friends a lot of the time, there are 63 members of the state Senate. And for the last 2 years, you and the Republican Conference have been involved in a partnership with the Independent Democrats, which is a 5-member independent conference. In the last 2 years, you formed a coalition government to govern with those folks. This year, the Senate Republicans won 32 seats outright. Simca Felder, who's a senator from Brooklyn, who has conferenced with the Republicans in the past, plans to do so again. So it looks like you guys have 33 votes going into the 2015 legislative session. Can you tell us a little bit about what governing was like with the IDC and maybe what the future is for that independent conference?
Yeah, I would say a couple of different things. First of all, it's not perfect and never was and never will be. And I don't think anyone would suggest that it was. Did it work? Yes. Were there bumps in the road? Of course. But there are bumps in the road. You could look at it and say, we have issues with the New York State Assembly. We have issues with the executive. But as I said before, at some point, people are willing to listen to that to a limited degree, and then they want to know, like, all right, put these differences aside. What the heck are you doing to make my life better? So on the whole, I think it worked well. I think of somebody in particular like a David Valesky, who is a gentleman, has been reelected time and time again. In many respects, I consider him to have more Republican-leaning principles than otherwise. And is he an easy person to work with? Sure. And that, I do think that's important for people to know. In my estimation, and I want to be clear, this is a personal opinion, I believe that the IDC is going to remain an IDC no matter how they affiliate. And I don't want to pretend to speak for them, but Senator Klein and his colleagues have kind of cut a, no pun intended, an independent path in laying out where they were and where they want to go. And they come at it sometimes from a different angle than us. But on the whole, if you look at the day-to-day operations of the Senate, things work pretty smoothly. And you know what? I want to be clear. When we say we pass 4 on-time budgets, that's good. But frankly, that's our job and that's the law. So I'm not lauding that as some fantastic accomplishment, but bringing some order, some discipline, some functionality to the legislature is good on a lot of different levels, including for the public. And let me just hasten to add one other thing. Whether you're a school district or a village or a town or any type of municipal entity, the certainty that can come from Albany particularly in relation to timing and funding, is extraordinarily important, and that allows for proper planning at all levels of government.
How did the majority coalition arrangement work? Did the was the majority coalition a conference that met, or was it two conferences that met separately and then coordinated through their leaders?
I would say two things. First of all, we did meet separately, but I would be remiss if I didn't very strongly suggest that Leader Skelos and Leader Klein were in constant and routine contact. And, you know, one of the things that doesn't always translate as quickly out to the public, our senior and key staff had constant work time and issues with the IDC staff. So did we formally meet as one conference on a regular basis? No. But did we work together closely on a wide variety of issues? Yes.
In terms of how the Senate has worked, let me lay out a history line and see what you think of it. Until 2007-2008, we had a traditional arrangement where the Republican conference had been in the majority from 1966 through 2008, and it was a traditional arrangement with a strong leader system similar to the assembly. Then in 2009-2010, there was a Democratic majority. In 2011-2012, there was a Republican majority, but it had a working relationship with the Independent Democratic Conference. And then in 13-14, the Republican Conference and the Independent Democratic Conference had a more formal majority coalition arrangement. So in the last 8 years, we've had four different approaches. Do you think that any of those worked better than others, and is there any lesson to be learned for the future?
I don't know if that's a softball or a tough question, because, you know, look, obviously...
It's a dissertation question.
Yeah,
it's
would,
to get your PhD in political
right.
science.
I think for me and for my colleagues, particularly in light of the seven new members that we have, I believe the public has spoken, and the model of us having a chance to govern as a clear Republican majority is something that I welcome and what I believe can be the most effective. But let me be clear, because I agree with your description of the facts, but, you know, go back to 2008. The public spoke, and every now and then we get that very gentle or very stark and direct reminder that the public is in charge, and they took us out of power for those 2 years, but correspondingly, they went after the Democrats with a vengeance because of how they governed 2 years that they were in a majority. So, you know, the public, while they may not always get the nuances in terms of structure and things like that, they understand who they are and what they want, and every now and then, whether turnout is lower or higher, the public speaks. So I think we're at a good juncture, and I welcome the opportunity to work with my colleagues and demonstrate to people all across the state that we know what we're doing, that we have their priorities in mind, and that we are trying to do really what is in the best interest of the public.
So if the public speaks in elections, then what were they saying 2 weeks ago on the statewide level? So, the you know, the governor won by a much smaller margin than he won 4 years previously. He won by 54-41 over an underfunded opponent. Eric Schneiderman, who was reelected as attorney general, got 156-42, you know, by a larger margin than the governor. And Tom DiNapoli, who... you know, won by a squeaker 4 years ago, got 60% of the vote to be reelected to state controller. So what do you think the public was saying about the governor's performance and which direction they think New York State is heading?
Well, I would say a couple of different things. If you take the controller DiNapoli, probably a fair description is a steady hand at the helm, you know, fiscal steward on behalf of the taxpayers and people who have pensions and things of that nature all across the state of New York. And they're... you didn't see any real consternation or huge negativity. Plus, the fact that the state has done well in the last 4 years in that regard is very important. In relation to the governor, I think the public has sent him a strong message. Clearly he won, so he deserves the accolades that come with winning. But as you say, it was not as resounding as it was 4 years ago. And there's an element, I think it was actually his father who used the term that you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose.
Sure.
And He's got a 4-year record, which includes many accomplishments, but there were some certainly issues that reverberated in ways that I'm sure he was not particularly pleased with. You can look at things like the SAFE Act and fracking and things like the Moreland Commission. If you look, the governor lost 46 out of 62 counties.
Right, sure.
And that's the kind of thing we, Republican, Democrat, Assemblyman, Senator, it doesn't really matter. We all pay attention to that. I look at my own election results and you think, okay, where are things going well? Where could they have gone better? And equally as important, how did that happen? You know, why do you thrive in one area? Why do you not do as well in others? The governor certainly, considering how much time and effort and money and energy he put into Buffalo, didn't do nearly as well as maybe he would have expected. But let me go back. He won, and now people not only know that he won, but they expect that we will continue to work with him, and I think he's starting to lay out some of his plans already. He made some new announcements and appointments in the area of education, something that I deeply care about and we'll be working on in great detail. And I do want to talk about that before we get off, but, you know, there are a lot of things that we need to do. And I don't want to sound, no pun intended, like a one-note Johnny, but people expect that we are now going to govern and do so in their best interest.
We're speaking with State Senator John Flanagan. He served this year as chairman of the Senate Education Committee and as Deputy Republican Conference Leader for Intergovernmental Affairs. If you'd like to learn more about Senator Flanagan and his work, go to the members link on nysenate.gov and click on Senator Flanagan's name. During the campaign season, Senator Skelos, a number of times, I heard him speak about the importance of getting rid of the so-called gap elimination adjustment. What are your thoughts on the feasibility of doing that?
My thoughts are very direct, and I'd like to think very much on point. So if you go back, and this is something where, Brian, you reference this, trying to explain this to people generally is not always the easiest thing. The way I describe it is, first of all, the governor didn't create this problem, nor did the Senate Republicans. This was a manifestation of what happened when the Senate Democrats were in charge, and when the governor came into office, he was handed a $10 billion deficit. And there were a series of difficult choices made at that time in concert with Republicans and Democrats to, so to speak, right the ship of state. And those choices were not things that anyone wants to embrace. And there aren't a lot of people who run around saying, first thing I want to do when I get in office is make cuts to education. So the gap elimination adjustment started out at about $2.8 billion, which in essence means that school districts were getting less than they were promised over a period of time, but now that number has been reduced, and there has been no group who has been more outspoken about the reduction and the elimination of the gap elimination adjustment than the Senate Republicans. I have bills, I have One House budget proposals, public statements, press conferences. We have listened very carefully to school boards, school districts, a lot of the educational associations and professional organizations throughout the state. Before anything else gets done, whether it's foundation aid or anything else, that gap elimination adjustment needs to go away. Because of our efforts in particular, we reduced that number by over $600 million last year, down to just slightly more than $1 billion, and in my estimation, for a variety of reasons, including being responsible to the school district, that has been the number one priority in education. And I do want to, as I was getting on, I did hear reference how the state had not really been funding education, and I frankly couldn't disagree more. There will always be a debate about what level the funding should be, but the single most effective thing we can do is properly fund public education in the state of New York. If you look at the state of Massachusetts, which had a property tax cap for over 30 years, they are amongst the highest performing states on a regular basis, in large part because they have properly funded public education. The better we do that, the less pressure there is on the local property tax. And going back to Senator Skelos' very basic points, the more jobs we create, the more revenue we generate for the state of New York. The more revenue we generate, the more opportunities we have to fund public education. But over the last 3 years, we've put close to $3 billion. $3 billion. And let me remind anyone who may be willing to listen, the reality is that education and health, but education in particular, has enjoyed the greatest bar yet of any part of the budget. And I agree with you. that's one of the things that gets frustrating for me and my colleagues. We have made great strides in financing public education, and I welcome the debate about the quality and content of our education system and how we spend our money, but we have put in a considerable amount of money, and my expectation is that the governor will come out with a proposal that will be a very good starting point for our budget deliberations.
So, Senator, do you think that we'll see more sort of austerity budgets from this governor? I mean, it's important to make about, you know, what kind of budget you expect to see him come out with. We're looking at a $5.1 billion surplus this year. Now, that may be a lot of one-shots from settlements reached with Wall Street banks, but clearly the financial environment is better now than it has been in the last several years.
I would say a couple of things, and here's where we make a slight distinction. We obviously have a property tax cap for municipalities and state districts, but at the state level, not only do I support our state tax cap, I voted for one, even though it's not the law. The Senate has passed the legislation to do that. Governor Cuomo, to his credit, has not fallen into the trap of don't do as everything, rather do as I say. The budget that he has proposed, once we have enacted in concert with him, has lived within the confines of what would be a spending cap or a tax cap at the state level. So New York State is not doing anything that we're asking the local government to do. Second thing is, you go back, this is where we have to be really, really careful and circumspect about the surplus. Frankly, I don't care if it's $3.5 million or $5.9 million or whatever the number would be. The reality is that when the state and other levels of government dabble in things like these, they tend to go back and bite us in places that we don't like. And if you go back, some of the issues that we've had with pensions, which are extraordinary, that some of those problems were created because there was a quote-unquote surplus in some of those systems, and we made changes that have made things more difficult. Let me give you an example of something that I think could be a mitigating factor, and yet I don't know how much attention is going to get paid to it. The contributions that are going to come into some of the retirement systems, including the teacher retirement system, they're supposed to go down. And I'm not talking like they're going to go down in a, you know, exponential fashion, but they are supposed to go down, which will in turn lower costs for school districts and taxpayers. Now, that's an effect that's a positive thing because it maintains the integrity of the system, but it also allows for schools to say, all right, I'm going to save, you know, $1 million here or maybe $2 million there on pensions, and that's something I can now put into academic program without having to go back out to my taxpayer and ask for more money. So I think we have to be not only diligent but very judicious in terms of what we do with that quote-unquote surplus money, because there's a lot, you know, there's obviously a lot of people out there who have found a litany of ways to spend that money, but infrastructure seems to me to be probably the amongst the smartest things that we could do.
Well, as the market has rebounded, pension contributions are going to go down for lower. So we're, you know, we're seeing that with the funds, both the teachers fund, the New York City fund, and state fund are digging themselves out of that hole. And they've had very good returns the last several years.
Right, but I also think, let me just hasten to add, it is extremely important that we don't do anything that would undermine the integrity of those systems and the beneficiaries.
We would agree on that.
Good.
In terms of the property tax cap, this is a technical issue that I would ask about, but I think it's important. Massachusetts has had a property tax cap for decades, Proposition 2.5. I think it started in the early 80s. The Massachusetts cap has significant differences from the New York cap. There's a cap, and it grows by 2.5% per year, whether you use it or not. So that's a flexibility that doesn't exist in the New York State proposal. In addition, in Massachusetts, it takes only a 50% vote, a Democratic majority, to override the cap, whereas in New York State, it takes a 60% majority. And my view of that has always been that it makes some people's vote more powerful than other people's votes. It would be a better situation if everybody's vote, those who support school budgets and those who oppose school budgets, counted equally.
Yeah, I would say a couple of different things. There's no question that there are differences between Massachusetts and the state of New York, and I don't want to intimate anything to the contrary. And Massachusetts is not a perfect model, but I do think on the basic points that I was making, again, proper funding of public education, you can do that and still have a viable property tax cap that meets our obligations and protects taxpayers, all working men and women, and regardless of the venue. So in the state of New York, we have a couple of unique factors as well. We made accommodations, frankly, for concerns that were raised by school districts and municipalities for things like changes in enrollment, things like tax certiorari and judgments in areas. But does it have the extraordinary flexibility? No, but the public spoke on these issues, and I think we can have arguably the best of both. You can have wise and prudent government investment and spending with an eye towards protecting the taxpayers, because a lot of the people who are, they're all paying the bills. Ultimately, it's coming out of the same pocket from the, you know, the taxpayers. So having said that, we have a five-year sunset, which makes us unique, because I could be wrong, but I do believe Massachusetts cap is permanent. So we have a five-year sunset. Clearly, it is tied to issues like rent control, which is a very unique set of circumstances, right, here in the state of New York. Sure. And that will be part of a healthy debate that goes forward. As to the 60%, I've had a multitude of discussions on this, and you know, I certainly sympathize with that, and I get it, but I guess the whole general premise and point was we were trying to make, in a collective judgment, Democrats and Republicans, senators, assembly members, and including a governor, trying to make a judgment that was saying it should be harder. It shouldn't be so easy to go up to higher levels. Now, I'll balance that by saying we are going to have an absolutely robust discussion on these things. Now, here's one that is boring in one way, but it actually matters. Things like pilot payments. How do you deal with issues like that for IDAs and what goes on in counties and trying to create economic development? All that is tied into the property tax cap, but I'm going to go back. The more we do to create jobs, the more we do to stimulate our economy, the more we do to generate revenue, will lessen the pressure on all those issues.
Senator Flanagan, this has been an enlightening conversation. I think you took a lot of credit for your broad view of public policy.
That is very thoughtful to say, and I appreciate that. And you know what? Let me throw in. We've been fortunate. I, in particular, have been fortunate to work with a lot of good people. I'm going into my 29th year of legislation. Proud to still work in government and be a public servant. But we believe in working mentally. And I've been very gratified, as have my colleagues, that we have continued to have the support of a wide variety of organizations. We feel that somehow we are serving our best interests.
This is the People's Business on WRPR Troy. We've been speaking with Senator John Flanagan, who this year served as chairman of the Senate Education Committee and has been a Republican Congress leader during the government of affairs. Senator Flanagan, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Terrific. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Take care.
If you would like to learn more about Senator Flanagan and his work, go to the members link on nysenate.gov and click on Senator Flanagan's name. Now I'm going to get the Nelson Rockefeller and Erie Canal not going to make a mistake again. For information on this Thursday evening's lecture by Richard Norton Smith about his new biography of Nelson Rockefeller, or about Friday afternoon's dramatic presentation on the workers who built the Erie Canal, visit nystatehistory.org. So NY, those are the initials, state, STATE, history.org. And you can get information on the events that are open to the public, and if you're a real history buff, spend a little bit of money. It's a very fair price. You can register for the whole conference and get a big dose of history on Thursday and Friday. And for the December 9th event on local fiscal stress, state austerity policy, and creative local response, being co-hosted by the Fiscal Policy